aquariums or aquatic research. But let's sort of start, Alistair, with the history of aquariums. How did these things come about?
Well, that's a great question. I got really interested in that after I started working in the public aquarium world, because it's sort of a history that goes back to the Enlightenment and sort of that really great awareness that people developed for natural history following out of the Age of Reason. And especially once you started to get into the Victorian era, when it seemed like everybody and their brother was a naturalist, and they were all going out, and all the hoity-toity folks were going out having great adventures in far-flung parts of the world and bringing back new species. It was like the ultimate age of citizen science, and that was when science really turned its attention to keeping aquatic things in an aquarium setting. And So
you make a very good point there. So you're saying these people, you know, you had a lot of people in Europe who would go on the grand tour, and they would collect artifacts from Egypt and Greece. They would bring back fish as well?
Well, they certainly brought back the idea of fish. And so in the sort of zoological world, I think the first people to get going with this was at the London Zoo. We probably shouldn't be surprised that it was in Europe somewhere. But it was at the London Zoo. They had what they call an aquatic vivarium. It was before the word aquarium was even invented. That didn't happen until 1854. When somebody contracted those two words together, aquatic vivarium, and made aquarium, which is the word that we use today. So aquariums are a modern concept, even though people have been keeping fish in what we would now call an aquarium since, you know, Greek classical sort of times.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
They didn't start looking at them through glass until a fair bit later. In the beginning, you just used to look through the top of the tank. It would be concrete or masonry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was more like what we would call a pond. We didn't do the glass thing until this sort of Victorian era, where people really wanted to look at these, and they were interested in fish as something other than something that you eat, something that you put in a tank and look at. That was a whole new idea, but it was all part of that Victorian naturalist kind of ethos.
That's kind of interesting, because the people that found the Grosvenors that founded or got involved in the National Geographic Society originally was probably an American offshoot of that, somewhat delayed in time. And you also have Teddy Roosevelt, who basically created the system of national parks, and it was probably part of that whole European movement of the naturalist.
Yeah, I think they flowed on together very nicely from each other. The first real aquarium, what we would call a public aquarium these days, was the one in Berlin, and that didn't open until 1869. So you were squarely into the second half of the 19th century for that. Prior to that, all the aquariums had been at zoos, but people started to say, you know what, there's enough here that we could sustain a whole institution by itself. And so the Berlin Aquarium opened, and one of their early attendees was a really cool guy called Felix Anton Dorn, a German evolutionary biologist. He was a big fan of Darwin. He was really excited about, because you got to think about the zeitgeist at that time, and everyone was really into, you know, evolution and this whole radical idea that animals changed over time. And he was really inspired by what he saw at the Berlin Aquarium. But he was also kind of an entrepreneurial fella, scientist, and he thought, you know what, I want to get my science funded, and I want my science funding to be insulated from normal sources of funding variability. So, you know, why not charge people to come and have a look at my experimental animals? So he had lots of fish tanks set up for scientific purposes, and he charged the public small amounts of money to come and look at that collection. And he made himself a self-sustaining aquarium called the Stazione Zoologica. It's in Naples, Italy. Don't ask me why a German guy was building an aquarium in Naples, but he did. And that was the first time that aquariums became truly scientific institutions.
How do you spell his last name?
Dorn, Dohrn, I believe.
Okay, interesting.
So let me just chime here and say that that's the most brilliant thing I have ever heard in my entire life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, Bill and I were working on an NIH proposal last week.
Yeah.
And you jump through all these hoops, and the probability of funding is low, and they've got all these restrictions, and they want half the experiment to be done before you even submit it anyway. And you're competing against so many people. I got to say, I think it's brilliant, although I don't think folks at Georgia Tech would necessarily agree. Lou Lefton, who was our guest host last week, and we went out, we gave a workshop on the use of humorous improvisation for a regional meeting of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers and how you can use that to catalyze innovation. We funded it, by doing stand-up comedy at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And it was just enough money to pay for our trip out there. And I was thinking, wow, this is a radical idea. No, it's been around for a long time.
It has been around for a long time. You don't need to have a big federal grant to get your work done. We have a very, very interesting funding mechanism for one of our projects at the Aquarium, where we've been selling silly bands to support our genome project. So that's, I mean, that's big science. Genome projects are science writ large. But you can support it with a little bit of help from a lot of different people, and doesn't have to be big federal funding to get stuff done. And it buys you a certain amount of independence from the funding treadmill, which I think most scientists will tell you is pretty grueling.
Yeah, exactly. And you've been involved in that as an academic. So, but do academics say, well, selling silly bands to fund your research doesn't seem like the right thing to do?
Well, they do until they see the cha-ching. Suddenly they're all interested in the idea. And it's
to quote the movie Back to School, you don't seem to understand, it was a really big check.
Ironically, you use silly bands to support, you know, your genome research at an aquarium. Silly bands, the one funny thing about them, they get caught in pool filters very easily. They're banned in my neighborhood because they get caught in a pool filter.
I did not know that.
What is a silly band? Would that be like the Archies?
No. It's this little rubber band that has a shape.
Silly.
And what are the shapes? So you actually knew what a silly band was. What are the shapes of your silly bands? Are they shaped like Orco, Orcus, or whatever? You know.
Well, because it's a genome project, we have an A and a C and a T and a G representing the four bases that go in DNA.
Totally nerded out.
And then, of course, the very popular one is the whale shark-shaped silly band, and then the aquarium's G-fish logo makes up the set.
Wow.
Cool.
That is totally cool. All right, so this is the most amazing thing I've ever heard. We need to take a quick break here, but let's come back, talk about this amazing funding approach
and some of the research
That's going on here at the Georgia Aquarium. And if you've got a question or comment about anything related to aquariums, the Georgia Aquarium, aquatic research, or silly bands,
or if you want free tickets, we'll tell you you don't get any, but you can call up anyway and ask for free tickets.
Go ahead. You're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1. Give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.